Look with me to the first chapter of the book of Romans, verses 18 through 23. The Apostle Paul writes in perhaps the most graphic description of the doctrine of the wrath of God the following: "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God hath shown it to them. For His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made, so that they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things." We've been looking at this book, The Shack. It's been for over 8 months now, sitting on top of the New York Times bestseller list for fiction. It has become something of a phenomenon. It isn't being compared as doing for this generation what Paul Bunyan's Pilgrim Progress did for his. That is, a great piece of Christian writing in which the truth of the gospel is communicated in such a winsome fashion. Now, I think it's a bit hyperbole to compare The Shack with Pilgrim's Progress, a book that has stood the test of time for over 300 years. I would wager you that in 3 years, people won't even know about The Shack. Now, despite the fact that it has got all kinds of accolades, we've been examining what I consider to be its serious shortcomings. As Al Mohler has said, this book distills undiluted paganism, idolatry, and heresy. Amongst the things that we've highlighted was, in the book, God appears to the central character, Max, after Max has had a traumatic experience. His youngest child had been kidnapped and brutally murdered while they were on a camping trip. And 3 years later, he gets a letter in the mail claiming to be from God, who says, "I would like to meet you out in the wilderness where your daughter was killed, in the very location in which the murder occurred." Well, Max is a bit doubtful, but angry as he is at God, he decides to go, and there he finds God incarnated in three persons. God the Father appears as a big, fat African woman who calls herself Papa. God the Son appears as a Mideastern young man with a big nose. And the Holy Spirit is incarnate as a little Asian woman who likes to garden. Now, there are a couple of problems here right off the bat. The Bible never portrays God the Father and God the Spirit as incarnate. In fact, God the Father is a spirit, and no man hath seen at any time. And whenever people claim that they saw God the Father, you can take it to the bank and bet it that they're lying. Well, people say, well, the book is simply fiction. The writer is trying to convey through this literary genre the significance of the triune God. Well, this is the wrong way to go about it. And not only is the doctrine of God seriously distorted just by virtue of the Father and the Spirit being incarnate, but in the process of the story unfolding, God the Father says that He was crucified along with the Son. Well, that never happened. And so there are some serious problems to begin with when we look at the doctrine of God. You see, you can have all your theological ducks lined up in a row, and you miss the doctrine of God, and the rest of them don't matter much. After all, what is it that really sets apart historic Orthodox Christianity from Mormonism? It's the doctrine of God, first and foremost. Trinitarianism is at the very center of Orthodox Christianity. Joseph Smith and the Mormons reject the doctrine of the Trinity, instead have a plethora of gods, all of whom have his own harem of goddesses by whom he populates the universe with. So the doctrine of God is basically a litmus test for whatever else we want to say. If your doctrine of God begins with a distorted picture of the Trinity, it's not part and parcel of the historic Christian faith. But there are other problems. And chief among them are this. The writer of the book, Paul Young, recently gave an interview. And he was naturally being quizzed about his book and all the critics that are lambasting it. Many of us are referred to as being mean-spirited and not having a proper perspective. But he was asked a very important question about, it seems from your book that you have no concept of the work of Christ in making an atonement being that of a penal, substitutionary atonement. To which he said, I reject that doctrine outright. Now, the doctrine of penal substitutionary atonement, simply put, is this, that by his death on the cross, Jesus bore the wrath of God. He suffered the penalty of the broken law in the place of a particular group of people. Christ did not die to make an atonement for everybody, carte blanche. He died to make an atoning sacrifice to propitiate the wrath of God for his people, who he calls his sheep. And you remember from John chapter 10, he said there were certain people that were not his sheep. So the doctrine of penal substitutionary atonement is at the heart of the gospel if you accept at face value what the New Testament has to say about the wrath of God. Now, if the wrath of God is somehow qualified in such a way as to render it simply the impersonal consequences of bad decisions. If the wrath of God is not the demonstration of the holiness of God vindicating His justice by satisfying His righteousness by punishing sin, then the penal substitutionary atonement is not only not necessary, but is an encumbrance. People have a difficult time with the concept of God's wrath. Simply put, the wrath of God is the manifestation of God's holiness when it comes into contact with sin. Pure and simple. God's holiness coming into contact with sin creates this combustion. And it is a righteous reaction of God holiness manifesting itself in wrath. Now, because we take our sins rather lightly, we have a difficult time thinking God is going to be that harsh. Doesn't it seem kind of harsh that God would punish people for their sins of a brief lifetime by spending an eternity in hell, paying the consequences of their sin? And it seems like that's awful unfair of God to do that. I mean, after all, this person only lived so many years. After all, why don't you just punish him for the time he was on earth? You know, recently something occurred that you're probably all aware of, is this great big Ponzi scheme that was recently uncovered in which a very well-to-do man, Madoff, was indicted for basically embezzling something like $70 billion. And that a lot of people were snookered into giving this man their life savings. Among them was the famous Holocaust survivor, Eli Wiesel. You all heard of him. He has written and tried to raise the awareness of the awful nature of the Holocaust and the things that the Holocaust victims who survived have had to deal with. Well, he not only lost $22 million of his own money, but $15 million of his foundation. He trusted this man. He gave him this money because the fellow says, I can get you a big return. And there were thousands of other people, many of them just common people, who gave this man their life savings expecting to get a sizable return on it. And now they're not getting anything. There were people who were in their 70s who gave this man their retirement. Now you think about it. You reach that age of retirement and you've got a nest egg. This is what you and the missus are going to live off of. And it's a couple of $1 million. And you should be able to live pretty well. And along comes this opportunity. You could get a good return on this. This man is a big mover and shaker. He moves with some of the big elite people in East Side New York. Some of his investors include people like Steven Spielberg. I mean, he makes money for his clients. You could make 15, 20, 30% investment. And so people wrote the guy the check. Here's my life savings. It's all I got. And they sit back and now wait for the money to roll in, only to find out they've been had. So, on Friday, this man appeared in court with his victims there and pled guilty. Said, I'm sorry. I'm ashamed of what I did. The money's gone. I don't have any more. And it's expected he will be sentenced up to 150 years of life in jail. The man is in his late 70s. Now, do you think that's going to in any way satisfy his victims? Oh, justice is served. The man's going to prison. But that's not going to give you your money back. He's going to die in a few years. He's not going to live out to serve that term. He's probably going to live maybe 10 more years at the most. And then he's going to die and that's it. Has justice been served? These people who will now live their lives, as one woman said, dependent on food stamps. I have to go back to work and I'm 70 years old because I trusted this man and he took all my money and now I'm destitute. Now, what do we say if we're on the receiving end of that? That's not justice. This man's only going to serve 10 years of a life sentence and he's going to die. Or what about the crimes of some of history's monsters? A Joseph Stalin, a Mao Zedong, an Adolf Hitler. What about their crimes against humanity? Shouldn't there be some kind of cosmic justice for people who do these kind of horrible things? Yes, you say there should be, and there will be. You see, God never judges unless there's a reason for him to do so. And our text tells us that the wrath of God is manifested for heaven because, and I'll just tick off the following, because of the ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. Now, notice which comes first. You know, we will highlight the things that humanity has done to each other. Do we not do that? But what's the first word in that phrase? It's men's ungodliness that produces their unrighteousness. Human wickedness stems out of the ungodly behavior of people who first and foremost reject the knowledge of God that He has given them. Because you see, it is the rejection of the knowledge of God that is the first indication that God is manifesting His wrath. I have given ample proof and it has been rejected. You know, we like to look at the catalog of vices that follow in which men's sinful behavior becomes transparent in human history. That is the consequences of God's judgment. It is the rejection of the knowledge of God and the idolatry which follows that is the reason God's wrath is poured out, and as a consequence, God executes judgment by giving people over to their sins. You see, the thing that is so disturbing when you read the shack, and I would not recommend you read it, it's a waste of time and money to read the thing. I read it only because I had to. Is the God of the shack does not inspire awe. You know, there's a story in the Bible about a man who had a grievance against God, who lost more than just a child. He lost 10 of his children, as well as his wealth and his health. And he had a difficult time coming to grips with why this was happening to him. And he wants God to give him an answer. Well, God does, finally. You remember the story of the book of Job. Job is upset with his friends, sorry bunch of counselors they turn out to be. And he is wanting to have himself vindicated. Not only in the eyes of his friends who thinks, well, look, you must have done something to deserve this. Job claims to be an innocent man. And finally, he gets the attention of God. And you know what happens. When God appears, what is Job's reaction? He puts his hand over his mouth and said, I did not know what I was talking about. The God of the shack appears as someone who's not threatened or threatening, who wants to commensurate with the character. The God of the shack doesn't inspire awe. The God of the shack is rather anemic. That's a rather pathetic deity, if you want to get down to it. You see, the God of the shack says, I'm not into this punishment stuff. You know, I don't like people to feel guilt. I've given you the quotes in the notes where he actually says, look, I'm not into judging sin. I'm into curing it. The God of the Bible is a different deity altogether. The God of the Bible is in the judgment business. The God of the Bible is most certainly going to judge human sin. Not only in the sense that there are consequences to bad behavior. You see, sometimes in order to dilute the notion of God's wrath being personal, we'll make it an impersonal process. You see, for some time now, there's been this notion that, well, you know, that's just metaphorical language. When the Bible speaks of the wrath of God, it's just talking about the fact that you're going to inevitably suffer the natural consequences of bad decision making. And so, you know, there will be a price to be paid for foolishness. Listen, there are a lot of people who will go through this life as crooks and scoundrels, and they'll never get caught by the hand of the law. They'll live out their life comfortably in the South Pacific or in the south of France with the millions that they have accumulated illegally, and no one will ever touch them. And they'll die at a good old age, and no one will ever know about them. They may have escaped the arm of the law in this life, but there's one to come. That's why the book of Hebrews, as we quoted last week, Hebrews 9:22, is appointed unto man once to die and then to face the judgment. It's the same writer who says it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Now imagine this, the living God as opposed to that which is the figment of people's imagination.